Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
Can you think of another species on Earth that has had more impact on human evolution, on our development in the last 5,000-6,000 years? Is there any other animal that has had a bigger impact than horses?
What can they teach us?
I think the world record on the horse is like 53 years old. Yeah, the oldest horse in the world.
Wow.
But most don't live that long.
Can hear me kind of breathe. Like, how long am I going to have to pay for this horse?
20 more years, yeah. 20 more years, Andy.
Many species are in crisis and need your help.
On how they were extinct in the wild, and international collaborations were made because we're like, whoa, this cannot happen. And they were bred in captivity and then re-released. Huge success story.
Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
All right, welcome to the All Creatures Podcast. I'm Chris.
Hello, I'm Angie.
And Angie, today we have to be very careful that we don't end up talking for like 7 hours.
I know. It's going to happen. You'll just have to edit it out.
I know. We have to get it down to 1 hour because that's our goal is 1 hour or less. And today we are talking about a special horse.
A very special horse.
Yes. The Przewalski horse is how I pronounce it.
Przewalski's is how I would pronounce it.
Right.
But I think for the remainder of the episode, you're just going to hear me say pee horse.
The pee horse? The horse that pees? Or is it just the pee horse?
Just the pee horse. Right. That's what I teach my son, and that's kind of the lingo in the industry because right. It's way easier to say.
Yeah, than the Polish version.
Yes.
Or it's also called what? What do we call it?
It's called a tacky.
Right. The tacky is the real name for the Przewalski horse. Yeah. But I will say Przewalski horse because that's what I tell my students and everybody else. Why are these guys so cool? This is. I know we've kind of alluded towards it. You know, we're a bunch of episodes in now. We've talked a lot about conservation. So, and one of the things you and I have talked about is not being all doom and gloom.
No, there's some wonderful stories out there.
Good stuff, mm-hmm. Right? And even the episodes like before we hit record, you and I are talking about our future episodes, and we want to bring some really cool stories, zoo stories. So we're going to be bringing that to the listeners here pretty quick in a few weeks. But this one is probably one of the best stories of conservation success.
Right. It's my all-time favorite. A, because I love horses. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And B, because humans help save these guys.
And you've taken care... Not now, I know you own some horses.
Yes.
And, you know, I've been working in the horse industry for close to 25 years now. Mm-hmm. But you own your own horses. And when you were a zookeeper, you took care of some. Not horses, but...
Zebras.
Zebras. They're cousins, right?
Yes, yes. And that's where yeah. I learned all about wild equids.
Right. There you go.
Before that, I had known a lot about domestic equids and lived with and taken care of horses for years. I kind of had my bleep handed to me.
Yeah.
My ass handed to me. when I started working with... Grevy zebras because it was a whole new learning curve. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. These guys are not domestic.
No.
Wonderful personalities and gorgeous as all get out, but they are not domesticated and very powerful animals. Just teaching me, give me a lot more respect for the evolution that must have happened.
Right. To survive in such a harsh environment in Africa.
Yes, yes. Right. And that's, I think, the zookeeper that taught me said, probably to smarten me up so I wouldn't do anything stupid around them, said, these aren't horses. A kick from one of these zebras is about as powerful as a hand grenade.
Yeah, they will kill you.
Now, I don't know if that's scientifically tested. However, it's darn strong because obviously any wild equid, mm-hmm. including the pea horse, has about one big kick to mm-hmm. get away from a predator mm-hmm. to survive.
Right.
So they use it, and so you don't.
And that's what's crazy, you know. And it just after the last episode we talked about leopards and predators,
mm-hmm.
and how we were kind of talking about they just don't take the sick or the weak. They actually go for healthy animals, and one kick from a zebra. I know leopards didn't go after grubby zebras, but lions, you see it sometimes on the nature shows, mm-hmm. Lions getting hit and mm-hmm. breaking bones and...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's horrible. It's horrible. Anyways, yeah, the wild's tough.
Even for domestic horses, this weekend, I took my family, we went to a little fall Halloween mm-hmm. festival to get pumpkins and do the hay rides and all of that. And it was also a a cattle farm too on the side, and we got to go feed the cows mm-hmm. and whatnot, which was awesome. But they had the horses and some of the horses in with the cows mm-hmm. because they work with them on a right. daily basis to move them from pasture to pasture. And I was, even me in my 30-something years, still learning. Right. I love to learn.
Right, right.
I was really surprised that there was two horses and about 20 had a cow. Mm-hmm. A couple of them had horns. One of them was a bull.
Mm-hmm.
And guess who was most in charge and got the most treats?
The bull? No, the horse?
The horses.
Really?
And I couldn't believe it. And I said to the rancher and the guy running this cool little Halloween event thing I went to, I said, I don't understand how these horses are so greedy. They're getting like all the treats, the cow cookies.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, yeah, those cows know one kick from that horse.
Is painful.
It's painful or end of life.
Yeah,
even.
They could kill them.
And so I just couldn't believe it. But so even on the domestic side of things, although they are technically prey animals, hoofstock animals, domestic horses and wild horses they're a force to be reckoned with.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Well, the Przewalski horse is, you know, we're going to talk a lot about horses today, obviously. That's why we got to try to keep it under an hour. But they're the last true wild horse.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. We always think of Mustangs here in North America. But the Przewalski is truly a wild equid.
Right, right. Like a zebra and like the Somali wild ass, like I said, which we'll talk a little bit about today. The Mustangs, or the ones in the United States, or even in South America and some in Asia, they're feral horses. They're coming from domestic populations that were released in the wild. Or the ones in America can date back to the Spanish.
Right.
In the 16th century, mm-hmm. mid-1500s, that got away from them. Or the Spanish actually, you know, reading some of the history in South America on the Criollo horses, they were purposely let go. And they thrived in these environments. And so they're feral. They're wild, quote unquote, but they're not a true wild horse. They've been domesticated for a few thousand years, handled by humans, bred by humans, selected for behavioral traits that made them less crazy, I guess.
Calmer, per se.
Calmer, yeah, there you go. That's a better word.
Because horses are still crazy.
They are still crazy. Some of them. Arabians, anybody? Good old Arabian.
And I think that's a very interesting thing. With their ability to be re-released into the wild, or if they were domesticated, then to move out back in the wild, because they are a prey animal and they just need to eat grass.
Right.
And obviously try to move away from predators. As we mentioned, we were talking about leopards and how they're a predator. That's a little bit tougher to re-release into the wild because a lot of the hunting skills mm-hmm. are really refined and taught from mom. And if you don't learn them from mom, they can be hard to learn. But yes, no, horses re-release tend to do pretty well. You're going to hear throughout this episode the happy feel-good story about the pea horse.
Yeah, the Przewalskis that have been re-released. So the Przewalski horse being the last wild, true wild horse, they actually went extinct in the wild. So there was no remaining wild horses, true wild horses. The domestic horses come from a lineage called a tarpon horse. That's where all of our domestic breeds came from.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went extinct in 1909. There was one left in Russia that went extinct before World War I. And then the Przewalski horse. So the Przewalski horse was all that's left. And it's actually, you know, the talkies, the name that we should be calling them. But most people are just going to recognize him as a Przewalski horse because it was named after a Russian, I guess he was a Colonel Nikolai Przewalski. It's a big Russian word, you know me and my words. So Przewalski is actually the Polish spelling. But he described the horse in 1881, and that's when the Europeans were like, oh, look at this cool animal, when the native people to Mongolia and China have known about this animal for thousands of years.
Right, yes.
But because, you know, us Westerners,
we like to classify things. Right, and right. So I think after early 1880s, when Przewalski had talked about them, then I think a lot of European zoos and wanted these specimens
of wild
to classify horse. Them to see, are they domestic, are they wild, where do they fall in, how do we put them in
a
box?
Yeah, and there was a big push. I mean, I guess not to poo-poo on my heritage, because of European heritage, that we did do a lot of good with nature and there was a big push in the 19th century to understand.
Sure, yeah, these were all museums, right, artifacts, right. Bones.
So even though we were kind of horrible to some of the animals and just, you know, one of my favorite museums in New York City, the Natural History Museum, and you go in there and you see all the specimens and the babies, they killed all those animals, you know, and stuffed them. And they're cool to look at, but then you're like, oh my God.
No,
baby cheetahs, like we talked about the last episode, and they're, yeah.
Oh yeah, no, I'm a Midwestern girl, so the Field Museum is where I grew up in Chicago, going to, and on the lower level floor,
it's all they have animals that
they have about one of everything, it seems like.
That they hunted, but you know, they don't do that much anymore. That was over 100 years ago. Anyways, okay, back to the Przewalski horse. So after World War II, there was only about two populations that survived, and like I said, they went extinct in the wild. The last sighting was in Mongolia in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
There was one stallion they saw, and then they never saw him again. And actually, it was kind of in the desert region of Mongolia, reading the story about that because humans have really pushed them out.
Of course, yeah.
That was like the last refuge for them, and it wasn't a very hospitable environment for the Przewalski horse. So went extinct in the wild, but thankfully there was handfuls of these animals in zoos around the world.
Right.
Then you boiled them down to 12 animals left that could reproduce. And that is where the population remained into the 70s. And that's all we had left was this dozen Przewalski horses. And
just to interrupt. Unfortunately, too, a lot of that was before we had reproductive technologies to potentially either harvest gametes or sperm or oocytes to freeze them and potentially have a higher genetic diversity.
Think, you know, if we jump a little bit ahead to the repro part, the reason this animal is doing well is because we do understand as much as we do about horse reproduction compared to other species like rhinos or elephants or, you know, lions. Even lions, I know. Well, we know we have domestic cats, so we can kind of compare that. But so with these 12 animals left in the late 70s, 1977, a group came together, mainly Europeans, but I'm sure some Americans jumped in there too, and other zoos throughout the world. They formed the Preservation and Protection of the Przewalski Horse, and they made a huge effort to breed these animals, carefully select their genetics, because as we'll get into, this population's highly inbred because there was only 12 animals left.
Right, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe they threw in a couple domestic horses
too. They did. So there was some, you know, so they're not really a true wild Przewalski horse that we had 100 years ago. There's a little bit of domestic genetics in there.
Very small.
Very small, but they did contribute a little bit to it. But the good thing is, out of these 12, it's led to almost 2,000 animals today and reintroductions into the wild. So it has been a huge success story for zoos conservation, and the efforts of conservation specialists to rehabilitate a species and put them back in the wild where they belong.
Yes, an international collaboration.
Yes, yeah, many countries, many different researchers, things like that. So talking about the reintroduction of these animals, they've been reintroduced into China and Mongolia. So there's five, I think it's... there's also been some release in semi-reserves in the Ukraine and Russia, I think, too. There's two other places that they've kind of... They're not so much in their natural habitat, but big parks that they've put them in to let them breed and reproduce and be fine.
Which they've successfully done.
Yes.
So there's been wild-born...
Przewalski horses, yep, that are running around Earth now.
Oh, so, that's so great.
So you had 12 in captivity in the late 70s to now you have about 700-800 animals in the wild that have come back. So that is the idea, the goal that we were talking about in the last episode, like with the Amur leopard, you have 60 in the wild, 200 in captivity. If we don't have these animals in captivity, they're extinct. Okay. If we didn't keep this Przewalski horse in captivity, the species would be gone extinct.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't let this happen. We can't let these animals go extinct.
No, and ideally, we would never get the numbers down to 12 or 60 or 50. Right. But unfortunately for a lot of animals, be it megafauna mammals and some of the reptiles and amphibians we've discussed, the numbers, unfortunately, are that low now.
Right.
And what will we do with that? Do we just let them live out their natural lives in the wild and most likely die off.
Right.
You know, or is there a way we can intervene? And if we do intervene, how much do we intervene? Right. How much does it cost? Who do we have to collaborate with? Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a wonderful group of scientists working and fighting for many of these
species,
but not all of them.
Right.
And with the pea horse, there continues to be great research here in the United States at the Smithsonian Zoological Institution. They are well known for their work with the Breswell seahorse and continuing to learn more about their behaviors and about their breeding, of course, right? Because we don't want this to ever happen again. And the cool thing is the Smithsonian Institute can boast first artificial insemination, a successful live foal.
Right.
It was born about like 4 years ago.
Right.
So really cool things. And they're trying to learn more and more about these guys. If the population, to re-release more, and then also, too, if there is a population crash, that we have a handle on the genetics.
Right, because we can talk about as far as the inbreeding with these animals and their lack of natural resistance to diseases and stuff. So if there was a deadly disease that wiped out the wild population, at least we have animals in captivity that as a genetic bank, right?
Sure, and it should be noted, too, that in Mongolia and China and some of these areas where they live, the weather can be very harsh and very cold. And in fact, there's historically several really bad winters that have not wiped the population out, but severely decimated it.
Right.
And we cannot necessarily predict with climate when that's going to happen again. So that's why you don't want to be down to 50 individuals again. You want the higher numbers. So
The natural
life cycle
back and forth with
it.
Yeah, and one of the things that, reading some of the scientific literature this week about them too, was I didn't really realize this, but the Przewalski horse, and it makes sense that I knew the equids played a big role, but they were actually one of the big four terrestrial species. There was, during the Ice Age, there was the mammoth, there was the bison, there was the woolly rhino. And then there was the Przewalski horse.
Like all my favorites.
Right. They're all, that's Angie's. That's, maybe you're just, your last life was in 10,000 BC.
Totally a reincarnated hoofstock.
Yeah, that's where you are. Then you just all of a sudden you just jumped 10,000 years into today.
Or I feel like I might be like an old blues player from the Delta. Yeah, one of those.
Probably
two.
Both.
Yeah, maybe.
Now, looking back at the evolution of the Przewalski horse and really, horses in general. No, this is great stuff. Because
should I go get a drink of water?
No,
take
a bathroom
later.
Break? That's later when I get to MHCs and get into a little bit of this genetic stuff.
Those of you listening for the first time, Chris really likes evolution.
Evolution's awesome. It's amazing because the horse is the best species we have. That
I do agree with that.
Evolution.
I was in 4-H at like 7 years old. I think I started, and I didn't even have a horse. I was just in 4-H to learn about horses. And my first project was hand drawing and mapping out the timeline from the horse as it evolved. Bear with me because I forgot my stuff from 20, 30 some years ago. I started with the Mesohippus.
It's down there. It's the Don horse's Eohippus. Okay. You're close.
Okay, one of those hippuses.
Right.
But anyways, I had
That's
to draw.
Good you remember that though.
Thank you. Since like 7 or 8 years old. 4-H. It's awesome. Sign your kids up. That's one of my mini plugs today.
Right.
But yeah, and then I had to draw it out, and it really was interesting to watch how they evolved from like a little fox-like critter into the modern-day horse.
Right, the huge horses that we have today. They've actually, where some of the megafauna have gotten smaller, like we talked about the rhino, the giant rhinoceros of Siberia.
What was a giant saber-tooth?
Yeah, I don't even ask me to say that word, but yeah the big, the one the size of a horse, where horses have actually gotten bigger. And actually, through breeding, today the Shire horse is the largest horse on Earth. We've gotten them as big as they've ever been versus not evolution naturally. They've gotten from smaller to bigger. So, yeah. No, that's good. That's good, Angie. You remember
Thank you. I also remember that they had toes, lots of them.
Yes, yes, yes.
And now they have one hoof.
Right. Now they're the odd-toed ungulates. The reason the evolution of the horse is so well-known is because they evolved in North America. Some a little bit bleeding into Central and South America, but mainly North America is where they evolved with rhinos.
Wait, so let's back up the bus.
Mm-hmm.
the horses came over with the Spaniards.
The domestic horses did. Okay. They went extinct in the U.S. or in North America about 10,000 years ago with that extinction with the megafauna.
Okay, but they stayed over in Europe then.
Yes, they were still in Europe and Asia.
Wow, okay.
So horses, Eohippus and Mesohippus and Merihippus and Dinohippus and all the hippuses.
All the hippuses.
You go up that tree. That all happened here.
Okay, cool.
And because we had such an interest in geology and archaeology and all that stuff, we've actually discovered a lot of their bones in North America. So we're able to describe the evolution of the species better than almost any other because there were so many bones in the ground that we have found. So you and then you see how they're those multi toes, you know, those 5, 4, 3, and then those three toes, the two outer toes start migrating up the leg, and we get bones with all these little nubbins and stuff as they go up. And I'll put some on the show notes and kind of show it to you. The one you were talking about, the Mesohippus, is one that I really think is cool because that is the three-toed horse. And they actually had kind of a hoof, hoof.
Okay, like an in-between.
Right. And then the two outer toes, the different species of Mesohippus, and I think Merihippus too a little bit. Those two outer toes, they've done some x-rays. Initially, like a long time ago, they were all weight-bearing. So those three bones were like very thick, I guess, is a good way to describe it. Very thick bones. So it shows that they held all the weight. Well, over 10 million years, as those two digits start to get less and less weight bearing, the x-rays, they get smaller and smaller, less dense bone. And then we have some iterations where those two outer toes are actually up higher on the leg with the horse. And then they get that one single hoof.
And now they have little remnants. Splint bones
and stuff, yeah. And then the night eyes and things that they think are remnants of that. Now, the rhino has kept the three toes, right? And they split off like 45 million years ago, a long time ago. And then the horse, the only one that's left, or, you know, there's horses, zebras, all those things.
Equids.
They came with the single hoof. So, yeah, it's very interesting. And obviously, I could talk about this for an hour, and I'm not going to.
I could listen. I could listen about all this.
Now, the one that they can trace them all back to is called the Hagerman's horse.
Mm-hmm.
And they found this one in Idaho. They think it kind of looked like a zebra and a donkey and, you know, kind of a smaller horse, pony-sized horse, I guess.
Okay.
Is the structure. That was like one of the very first equus, you know, equids.
Of what we think.
Forerunners, right. Forerunners of today's Przewalski horse, right? Mm-hmm. So that's who we're talking about today. So you can go back to them, their ancient ancestor, and then they split off. And then in horses, they talk about the Cabaline lineages, the non-Cabaline lineages. The Cabaline lineages are your horses. Your nons are your asses and zebras. And then so you have your Asiatic wild ass. You have your African wild ass. Then you have your multi-species of zebra, the Grevy's, the Grants, the Mountains.
Yeah, there's like three of them. Yeah,
the three big ones. The donkeys, and I know we kind of talked about this, and I'll talk about the Somali wild ass real quick. That is the most endangered equid on the planet today, I think. And I didn't know this, but it was really you that told me all about this one. And Angie said, you need to go visit this conservation center.
Because it's awesome.
It is awesome.
I want to frolic around there.
I know. I want to live there. Oh, I just want to live there all day. And starting down this path so many years ago, I've learned about the Somali wild ass. And I went with her to a conservation center here in Florida where they are very successful in breeding these animals. There's maybe 300 left in the world.
Not a lot.
Yeah. No. And they are just beautiful. And they are actually the last wild donkey, I guess. Yes. We call them wild asses. I mean, that's their name. But they are where donkeys came from, mm-hmm. where all of our donkeys came from.
And they're beautiful.
Domestic donkeys. Yeah, they're beautiful. They got the white striping. And they were part of the African wild ass.
Mm-hmm.
There was the Nubians, which went extinct about 30 years ago. Atlas wild ass in North Africa went extinct in like 1300s.
Okay.
And then you have the Somalis, which they are in a very tough situation because sure, they're in a very hard part of the world, right?
Well, and they're more, yeah, they're more, like you said, they mentioned, they are more endangered than actually the Przewalski horses.
Right, yeah. They're
as far as if you're looking at a numbers game, of course, zoological institutions are breeding them and mm-hmm. hoping to do similar things with reintroduction as they did with the pea horse. However, there are lots of challenges mm-hmm. because of their natural habitat and where they're located as far as conflict.
It's really hard part of Africa mm-hmm. and Somalia and mm-hmm. Eritrea and that part of the world. Ethiopia, I mean, Ethiopia is a pretty stable country, but that part of the world is very contentious, right?
Sure.
Southern Sudan.
Right.
You know, right.
So you don't necessarily want to release an animal if it's not going to do well with either illegal hunting or
being killed for meat.
Mm-hmm. I mean, or bushmeat.
Yeah, bushmeat that, hey, here's an animal, let's eat it. And they do that to survive. So, but thanks to Angie, I started down this path and really started jumping into, we did some behavioral studies with these guys, some minor stuff, and then just getting involved with now rhinos and elephants and all the things, that, the great things that we were doing. Now, the difference between a Przewalski horse and a domestic horse, there are some major differences.
There are.
Right, right. And what's cool about the Przewalski horse, and I guess we'll talk about some of the physiology, they're pretty standard, whereas today in horses, as far as what they look like.
Yeah, they all look alike. They all have a similar coat pattern. They're all similar in size. Right. I mean, obviously, besides juveniles and then, male and females, but they look a lot alike.
Right. And we're domestic horses. We have little ankle biters. I call them ankle biters, the mini ponies, which are hilarious.
Mini ponies that you can make wear boots and they can be in your house. So not that I want that.
No.
In case my husband's listening, I would never want that.
Yeah, never want a mini pony in my house.
And little boots.
Yeah. No, they're pretty cool. And then you have the Shire horse, which can stand like 7 feet at the shoulder, which is incredible.
Humongous, yeah. Right. And all different coat patterns mm-hmm. and all different. Yeah.
So humans have done a lot of selection and breeding for certain traits. Whereas the Przewalski horse, obviously they look the same. But genetically, really quick, and just talk about chromosomes. Come on, chromosomes really quick.
All right.
In the chromosomes of the cell, the horses have 64, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we know that we get 32 from mom, 32 from dad. We won't do a whole genetics lesson.
Do you know, really quick to interject, as a student, I always have to, you have to learn, memorize all these facts.
Right, right.
And I always use tricks to help me memorize things because, well, otherwise I would never be able to memorize all.
Never pass your exams.
I would never pass any exam. And so, interestingly enough, I can always remember the horse is 32.
Right.
But I always forget what humans is.
Oh, yeah.
I always forget how many human have. So since a horse has 64 or 32, I take that 32 number. And humans are the reverse. Yeah. Humans have 23
right.
or 46.
Right.
Is that math right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you can add. Yeah.
So all listeners out there, if you can remember that a human has 23 or 46, you can remember that a horse has
32 or 64.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can remember, and we should probably do a plug, and they should probably pay us some money, is 23andMe.
Well, now there's that too. Yeah.
So I remember that.
You have to remember the humans now. Yeah,
23andMe.
Have you done that? I haven't done that.
No. But I know it's coming, like as far as genetic medicine, and we're getting there with technology.
Yeah, it might be a fun Christmas present for like my husband or something.
23andMe. Is that Ancestry?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. we're mutts. We're living in the U.S. So.
Mutts make the best dogs.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? I love
I'm a German for sure. Croatian, Serbian. So I'm at conflict with myself because they don't like each other.
Well, you think this, but see, you could do the 23andMe and there might be some other stuff in there.
And then I can go question my mother.
Exactly.
Mom, don't listen.
Every grandparent's worst nightmare, yeah. Right?
All of a sudden I'm Spaniard. What?
Little Native American thrown in there. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised.
No. So the chromosomes are different in the Przewalski. So horses, we know, domestic horse is 64. Przewalski horses is 66. And right. Then even if you look at donkeys, and donkeys are all 62. So mm-hmm. all the wild asses and donkeys are 62. Zebras are all over the place. You have 56, 44, 32, and 45.
Truth be told, I have never memorized the zebra ones because they're all different.
They are way different.
Which is kind of annoying.
Yeah. And looking at zebra and donkey evolution history, they all came from a similar ancestor about 2 to 3 million years ago.
Migrated
to Africa, and then one split off to become zebras, one split off to become donkeys, and now they have tons of different zebras. Yeah, and all different chromosome counts, which is weird. So anyways, the whole purpose of this is to show that the Przewalski horse is not the originator of all of our domestic horses.
Exactly.
It's the tarpon.
And
that's now extinct.
The tarpon for the horse.
Right, for the horse.
And also for all of the pea horses that have been either in a captive setting or reintroduced, even though there might be a little bit of domestic horse in there, they all still have the 66 chromosomes.
Right. So they're still sitting at 66 chromosomes. So we know that our domestic horses did not come from them. Doesn't mean, like, you know, a long time ago, a Przewalski horse had some influence on there, but they're really not. They're really a separate species, lineage of Equidae. So interesting stuff. Now, what we do know about the historical ranges, like I was telling you, the bison, woolly rhino, mammoth, and the Przewalski horse really range, and probably tarpon horses too, to some extent, range from Asia to Europe, North America. Went extinct in North America with the megafauna extinction that happened with when mammoths got wiped out, but still persisted in parts of Asia and Europe. And then really, probably because some of this domestication was happening, and, you know, as humans settled more of Europe, more of that part of Asia, these animals got pushed farther and farther east into Mongolia, remote regions of Russia.
And that's where we think of them.
Right, today. Mm-hmm. So looking at the scientific history of them, and what scientists think is they probably ranged all over the northern part of the world, but due to human pressure, they've really gotten fragmented down the last few thousand years to where historically, right, in the last few hundred years, what we do know for sure, you know, really goes back from like Genghis Khan onward to the last 600-700 years, that they've been isolated to Mongolia, parts of Russia, and parts of China. So that's really where they are, and that's where they're being reintroduced today. But like I said, there's a couple parks in Russia and Ukraine that have done that.
Now, Chris, speaking of Genghis Khan, doing a little bit of research into the history with humans and our background with these beautiful pea horses, they, of course, are in tons of cave paintings everywhere, of course, from China and Mongolia, I think even into Greece and Rome.
Right.
So, you know, and that's, you know, tens of thousands of years ago. But even more recently in the literature with Genghis Khan, there's a story goes that one of these pea horses crossed the path of Genghis Khan riding one of his prestigious mounts. And his horse, his domestic horse, reared and spooked upon seeing this pea horse. And so whoever caught and brought him one of these takis, one of these wild horses, would, you know, be forever endowed, be great. And this was when they brought him a pea horse, it was considered a very prestigious and rare gift because these wild horses were not domesticated and were so and were so hard to catch.
Right, and so elusive, right?
So they've kind of always become this symbol of, you know, which even in the North America, Mustangs are wild, and, you know, freedom and all of that. And I think
the symbol of it.
I think that has stayed true historically, you know, even now. And then the other main really important fact for the history of humans, you already touched on how they were extinct in the wild and re-released.
What drove them,
And how we internationally came together as a community and said, wait a second. Now, fast forwarding now to our current history with them, you already touched a lot on how they were extinct in the wild, and international collaborations were made because we were like, whoa, this cannot happen. And they were bred in captivity and then re-released. Huge success story. But I think it's interesting to take our human history with them, or take what we learned. There's some quote out there. It's probably by Einstein or who even, you know, I could Google it. But where they say the definition of insanity is doing the same thing twice.
And, over and over.
Over and over and expecting different results.
Right.
And so I think that with these, you know, with the successful story of them being reintroduced, we need to learn why they went extinct in the first place.
Right. Yeah. What was the pressure? What was the cause?
And we've touched on a lot of it with in our other podcasts, but with the pea horse, the Dingo, you know, a big, large land mammal that, you know, really went extinct in the wild. I mean, basically experts have traced it back to differences in cultural and political beliefs, which, hello, I mean, what's happening here in the States?
Yeah.
Of course, hunting, and that could either be, you know, whether it's illegal or legal, climatic change. And, you know, these are all things that we're seeing here in this day and age. Then, of course, competition with livestock and land pressure. I mean, these, and I'm sure you'll get into it in the diets of what these animals eat, but they need, they eat grass and they,
all day,
and they eat it like 16 hours a day and they need a lot of it.
Right.
So they need room and they need to be able to find this grass, and they're not migratory. Mm-hmm. At least currently they're not, but is that because
we isolated them,
right? We make them not migratory or whatnot. So, and then once again, too, animals that live in harsh climates, especially like in China and Mongolia, I mean, harsh winters can knock out their population. Right, right. And then these are truly wild horses. And grant, they live in a reserve, but the reserves they live in are, I mean, humongous.
Huge, yeah.
Huge.
Yeah,
yeah. And so, but then there's competition for water and, mm-hmm. and other resources, mm-hmm. which naturally, historically, they would have that competition. But it's even probably more concentrated when there's less room and more animals.
And we even, you know, it's funny, you even see some of that in the United States with the wild horses. The debate that's going on within this country as far as how to manage them, what's the sustainable population, and ranchers in conflict with wild horses.
Absolutely.
You know, there's people out there, you know, raising cattle on these lands in direct conflict with wild horses. So that's a big discussion in this country.
It is.
It's a nightmare to try to deal with it because these animals don't have their natural landscape, right? We've isolated them to pockets in this country, and we're like, this is where you're going to live.
And they happen, and they have to be very successful.
And they're breeding really well.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a balance of like they're starving. Some of them are starving, you know, whatever. So yeah, same thing with Przewalski horse in that part of the world.
So yeah, I think one of my other take home messages today is that they're complex issues why species mm-hmm. go extinct, and they're different for different species. But there seems to be a lot of similar patterns.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's a bunch of stuff coming together at mm-hmm. once, like right now.
It's like
so the last
synergy,
years,
but synergy is like a positive word. This is like
bad mojo coming
dis-synergy, up. Dis-synergy. Yeah, I don't know, horrible. Some word I just made up. But yeah, so it's, you know, it's not just like, oh, let's not hunt them. That, you know, oh, let's not, you know, let's give them as much land as possible. Right. There's just a lot of angles.
It's got to come, yeah, it's got to come. We have to come together. And it's multiple solutions. It's not just one.
Yes.
It's not just recycling, or it's not just turning off the lights, or, you know, conserving certain things, or driving a more energy efficient car.
Right. Or being
a
vegetarian.
That's big. Each one is big.
Huge. And each one, I mean, everything, every little bit helps.
Right. But you need to do them all if we're going to make a big enough impact. Okay. So let's get back to some good stuff. Feel the good stuff. I love, obviously you and I love horses and the history of horses.
Chris, you know why I love horses?
What?
I just like looking at them.
Okay, they're pretty. But let me ask you this. Here's why I love horses. Because they are amazing animals. And they're amazing to work with. They are intelligent. They are loyal. They are, you know, fun. It's so much fun to work with them and ride them and be around them. But let me ask you this. This is one of the major reasons I love horses. Can you think of another species on Earth that has had more impact on human evolution, on our development in the last 5,000-6,000 years? Is there any other animal that has had a bigger impact than horses?
I mean, I know where you're going with this, but I would say no.
I mean,
as far as
we domesticated chickens, they're yummy, and the eggs are great, right?
We have domesticated cows
and
we
pigs.
We love our dogs. And my dog makes me a better person.
Better, and they were good to help keep us safe.
Right, but I cannot ride my dog into a warfare.
No, and not just warfare, but what? Like,
or to the store.
Right. Or spread our genetics.
Yeah.
Or populate the earth. Now, it's bad news for the rest of the species because thanks to horses. But for us, it has been amazing. Horses have changed the trajectory.
Horsepower.
Of human evolution.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for horses, we would not be sitting here recording over a computer, you know, where we're going to send this out into cyberspace and people are going to listen to it. Thanks to horses, because if we didn't have them, we'd still be back, probably not be hunter. I mean, I imagine we would evolve eventually.
Sure.
Maybe we'd ride cows. I don't know, but cows aren't very efficient.
No.
But because of them, because somebody was brave enough, man or woman, probably a woman, right? You know,
of course, probably like a grandma.
Probably grandma. Got on the back of a horse for the first time. And they were able to not only spread out, but trade. Yeah, warfare obviously is a horrible human condition that we have still. And that helped, you know, drive some advancements. But still, if it wasn't for horses, we would not be where we are today.
Yeah, I mean, survived off of them in certain right. cultures. Yeah,
and you know, people still do eat horses. Mm-hmm. But that all started about 6,000 years ago. And
But it should be clarified that the pea horse is not a part of this.
No, it was not. That was the tarpon.
Right.
But, yeah, it's still sell the horse. You know? Yeah, that's why I said this could turn into an 8-hour podcast about horses, but it won't. Just really quickly, so the domestic horses, there's almost close to 60 million. It's about 58 million horses worldwide. Almost 600 breeds, like we said, from the ankle biters up. And they're awesome. Przewalski horses. So we know a lot about Przewalski horses because we know a lot about domestic horses. Physically, not a whole huge difference besides, different chromosome count. But even, you know, the physiology of a Przewalski horse is the same as a Grevy zebra, mostly.
For the most part, for sure.
Are some differences. And I picked the Grevy zebra because it's not always your favorite or one of your favorites.
No, it's my hands-on favorite.
Favorite. Okay. Your hands-on favorite. So the Grevy zebra, you know, is so cool because it's desert loving and, you know, they are just awesome looking. Different stripe patterns.
Yeah, they're bigger and their stripes go all the way around the belly. They don't have the typical white belly that you think of.
The physically, the brain, the teeth, the stomachs, most the same.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Reproduction, same.
Right. So that's what we know a lot about. Now, in Przewalski horse, males are called stallions. Females are called mares. Babies are called foals. All the stuff we love about them.
Can you see me smiling right now? Just mentioning those words makes me happy. I'm such a dork.
I know. I love the baby horses, though. They're the best. Or baby zebras. Or, you know, we talk about baby cheetahs.
Anything.
Baby. Yeah, I don't know. You said baby leopards, snow leopards, probably the clotted leopards, cutest. I don't know. Even baby horses are pretty great, even though they bite you sometimes.
They're love bites.
They are, yeah. You know how many times I got bitten in the butt from a baby foal?
Oh, absolutely. With mom. Absolutely.
All right. Przewalski horses can live up to about 30 in the wild. 20, mid-20s is probably average. And even domestic horses, that's kind of an average lifespan. But, you know, even with medicine, a lot of horses can live into their 30s.
Yes. Yeah. I have a 32-year-old mare right now that's healthy as can be.
Yeah.
Healthy and happy.
Yeah. So they can live in captivity that long.
And spoiled rotten.
And spoiled, yeah, of course. I think the world record on the horse is like 53 years old. Yeah. The oldest horse in the world.
Wow. Yeah.
But most don't live that long.
You can hear me kind of breathe. Like, how long am I going to pay for this horse?
20 more years. Yeah. 20 more years, Angie. But yeah, they, you know, life cycle is going to be the same as our regular domestic horses. By about 3, they're teenagers, almost adults, almost fully grown at 5. The Przewalski horse is about a medium size, pony size horse. You know, not quite as tall as a thoroughbred or, say, American quarter horse.
Yeah, it's probably like a big pony size.
Right, big pony.
So for our listeners out there, when we say pony, we don't mean like My Little Pony or like a baby. Yeah, like a baby horse, or it just means a smaller size.
Small horse. Like they're 5 feet at the shoulder or 142 centimeters at the shoulder.
There you go. Hey.
I'm getting my
Mr. Metric.
Yeah, my metric stuff. So they only weigh about 700 pounds. So yeah, an Arabian horse, which we think is a smaller, normal, average horse, is about 900 pounds.
Yeah.
Maybe some of the smaller 700-pound ones. So they're not huge horses, but not tiny either.
They're really robust and sturdy.
Yes.
For muscular, the harsh climate that they live in.
Yeah, very muscular if you've ever seen them. And I know, like, you didn't get to work with these guys. I've seen them at the National Zoo. I've seen them at the San Diego Zoo.
The two of the bigger players in the industry,
Right, that have Przewalski horses. Now, there's 1,200 in captivity, but there's a lot in Europe.
A lot in Europe, absolutely.
Yeah, and then, like, these parks in China, Mongolia. Mm-hmm. Even though they're releasing a lot in the wild, they still have a bunch in captivity that they're watching.
Of course.
Right? Making sure they're healthy and stuff. Yeah. So their coats, you know, their coat colors, they're done with the reddish hues, generally. Really interesting, they have the primitive markings. So when we say primitive, that means we're going back, like the Somali wild ass has those primitive markings on the legs, like the stripings, like zebras have the striping. So these guys have some striping, you know, faint striping on their legs, the dorsal stripe down their back. They have a light underside and muzzle, which is like a donkey or wild ass. So, and you said some of the zebras don't have stripes along the bellies. So again, very equid, looks like a horse, stuff like that. And I'm sure they behave just the same, right?
Yeah. I mean, for the most part, they behave like a lot of similarities to a lot of wild equids. They're a little bit different than some of the other wild equids, as far as I know, mostly about zebras, of course, is they don't migrate for what we know of them in the wild. They typically have a very big area. Studies over Mongolia and China have estimated their home range between 150 up to 825 kilometers squared.
Right.
And they always look for a permanent water source, which makes sense. And then they like grasslands and patches of forest with rocks. And overall, they're not really a territorial species. But similar to horses, wild horses and horses in general, Przewalski horses are very gregarious by nature. And a group of horses is called we always think of a herd.
Right.
But another way to look at it is, or another word is a harem.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, like it was seen with most zebra species, of course, not the grevies. They're different. That's why I like them. I like the underdogs.
Yeah.
But in general, typically with wild equids, there's usually one dominant stallion, lots of mares, and lots of young foals. And horses, in general, have a dominance hierarchy. And if you are ever watching horses, you don't have to know anything about horses or about dominance. All you have to see is if you open a gate, which one comes in first, which one comes in second, which one comes in third. And
all the way down the line.
And
it's like strict military, like very strict.
Very strict.
Yes.
And they usually work it out in the beginning of and then they know where their place is. Now, if your number, if you're ABC, if you're C in line and B should pass of old age, there's a good chance you might be challenged by D, but you could move up to the next position.
And become,
besties
with A.
Yeah. So, but in general, even with this dominance, horse communication is very complex. And it's similar in Przewalski horses.
Right.
So once again, whenever I'm working with young students, you don't have to know a lot about horse behavior to understand what they're thinking for the most part, either towards you or towards the other. And so horses, what I tell people is they talk with their ears.
Right. Yep.
And it's the same with Przewalski's horses. They are going to communicate. They can, if their ears are forward and kind of in an erect position, they're alert or looking around and maybe looking out for a predator.
Or interested, too.
Or interested. Yeah. Oh, hey, do you have a treat in that bucket for me?
Yeah.
If their ears are kind of just off the side, that usually means they're relaxed.
That's right.
But the biggest one you want to look out for, and the biggest one that is part of this dominance hierarchical behavior that they have, is their ears when they lay their ears back. And they can lay them back all the way flat till it basically touches the back of their neck,
the main area.
It's called pinning their ears. And when you see that, then that's going to usually be followed by a bite, a kick, a something else.
Strike him.
But they use it as a warning sign. So therefore, horses are very sensitive. And in general, like with a lot of pets, maybe your dog too, but definitely in the horse world, you probably have always heard people say, oh, horses can read your behavior. Horses know when you're scared of them.
Right.
And I don't know if there's a scientific study to it. That maybe someday somebody will pay me to prove that concept.
Right.
Anybody out there listening, but there's truth to it. They are very sensitive. But I think a lot of it's just because they are used to watching all their other herd mates, or they've evolved to have these complex social structures.
They're very perceptive.
They are very perceptive.
Yeah.
So they can pick up on body languages and things like that.
Yeah. Working with new students that are scared, some of these horses are, 500 kilograms or 1,200 pounds. They're big and they're strong. And so they are intimidating. And when you go in and you're intimidated and you act like that, the animal knows, oh, I'm dominant.
Right.
And so they take advantage of the situation. But anytime I'm working with them, I'm dominant. I'm the one in charge. And I've seen little kids. They're in charge, man.
Oh, yeah.
And those horses know.
Oh, yeah.
The little Spitfires. I'm in charge. And those,
my little tiny dictator at home. my almost 4-year-old.
Because my 2-year-old is like that.
I have two of them. But my 4-year-old is, he's so funny. He he tells those horses what to do, right, and right. he thinks, you know, and then, but it's a good confidence booster, mm-hmm. And because he's grown up around them, he doesn't have a fear of them, and of course, I only put him around safe right. animals. But so yeah, they definitely have a lot of signs of dominance and power and aggression. Mm-hmm. People that work with them and other horses understand. But on the flip side, horses, and including Przewalski horses, also have a lot of in the industry, we say affiliative mm-hmm. or social behaviors.
Very social, yeah.
Very, very social as far as standing side by side, nuzzling each other. And then there's another fun behavior we call mutual grooming. So it's kind of in the human world. Right. You scratch my back, I scratch your back. Yeah, my husband, you massage my foot, I'll massage your foot. Or sometimes we massage each other's feet at the same time.
Gross.
So it's, I know, right? Not after a day of work, right?
Yeah, the zoo world.
Sometimes after a day of work. Let's be it. Yeah, we're tired over here. Yeah. But yeah, so they basically will stand, head to tail, and groom each other on the neck. And you see that a lot between friends. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, too, because little foals are and yearlings and whatnot are in this harem, mm-hmm. the foals and the yearlings have to like tell the big stallion like I'm not a threat.
Right.
So especially a newborn foal, they do this really cool behavior called clapping, mm-hmm. where they open their mouth and they don't make any vocalization. They just kind of snap
back and forth,
and they're basically saying. And I don't know what they're saying, but I feel like they're saying like, please don't kick me. I'm just a baby.
Yeah, I'm a baby.
And, you know, and the big strong stallions know that and right. they, you know, and they work with them really well. So yeah, a lot of, social behaviors mm-hmm. in terms of evolution, these behaviors help them survive. Right. Right.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, you gotta have strong bonds,
strong numbers, right. survival.
Again, and that goes back to, you know, some of the themes that or develop. It's funny, each episode we discuss kind of the same stuff. And I mean, I know we kind of have the show laid out to talk about these similar things, but there's a similar thing that I'm noticing that where these animals are not just dumb, you know, walking around, grazing.
Oh, and, Chris, not at all.
They're super intelligent.
Not at all. A lot of my earlier graduate work, mm-hmm. I worked right. with them hand in hand and trying to understand
okay,
their.
You got to tell this. This is my favorite. I mean, I always scream about Angie and, you know, Angie's, all my other grad students, I love you. Angie's definitely has been the one that's
it's okay to have
huge,
favorites.
Yeah,
we
has
all
had
have
an impact. I mean, starting with my first one, he's tough to beat. He's DVM, but
yeah, he's a good guy.
Each one I get is almost better than the last one. Angie has done phenomenal work in this study. Angie, you got to briefly talk about it because I love bragging about this study.
Well, it was a lot of fun. I was tasked with wanting to assess the cognition of baby horses or mm-hmm. foals. I want to test their ability to learn how to touch a target stick, just basically a buoy with a stick on the end with their nose to it.
Right, so it's target training.
Yeah,
and you guys do that. And it's weird because I mean, unless you really study animal behavior, but in the zoo world, they use that quite a bit to get them to present,
sure.
to give them medications or get them to walk where you want them to walk.
And that's where I stole the idea right. from, with all my experience in with positive reinforcement training in the zoo setting, because mm-hmm. you can't make a zebra come to you.
No.
But it has to want to come to you, and right. through this type of training, the animals want to work with you, and then that way the vets can check on them, you can be safe around them. Right. So yeah, so I stole that, and it worked wonderful with these mm-hmm. foals, which are kind of like little wild animals to begin with.
Which is great, because they were, what, 2 months old?
A
month old.
They were
six weeks. 4 weeks old
they
when you
4 started
training them. 4 weeks
old when I started it, and they basically learned it so fast. Both groups.
It was crazy.
Both groups learned it so fast. I did not see a treatment difference. Okay. But one of my design flaws of the study that I realized, of course, after the fact, is that I didn't challenge them enough. Like
right.
they probably needed to be challenged more. And then perhaps I could have tweaked out a difference between the ones that were exposed or not mm-hmm. exposed. But the summary of my research is at 1 month old,
you can train a horse.
And this was, Chris, this was 5 minutes a day for like 5 days.
I know. That's what's insane about it. It wasn't
super
like you were
quick,
like
no,
hours and hours
no,
of training.
No, no. It was very,
they
very
picked fast. It up like mm-hmm. super fast.
And then what we did is in a month later, A, we saw if they remembered it,
right.
which they did like in split seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And then B, if we could take it a little bit further. And then
you followed them out. I mean, just because we'd spend all day talking about this study too. When they were year old and 2 year old.
Sure.
And then you saw treatment differences.
We did. Yeah. I saw a little bit. We followed them out when they were 6 months old. There was a little bit of a treatment difference to learning new tasks like trailer loading.
DHA was helpful.
Seemed to be helpful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, Chris. And so what was really exciting was then when we followed them out at 6 months and then 1 year and 2 years mm-hmm. later, we always tested their memory, but then we challenged them with even harder tasks.
Right.
Using the target training, and we found at 6 months that the ones exposed to DHA in utero, granted they had not been in the supplement since they were in utero.
Right, they were just exposed to it
in mama's belly. They responded a little bit quicker to trailer loading, mm-hmm. and then learning the bridling mm-hmm. task at 1 year old, and then at 2 years old, testing their memories again. Mm-hmm. I didn't do any new tasks, but I just because they were at that point, they were already in a riding program.
Right, they were already being trained. Mm-hmm, right.
Yeah, but I just tested their memory of it, mm-hmm. and yeah, the ones that were exposed to DHA seemed to remember quicker or respond more positively, whichever way you want to look at it. But you know, our numbers were low, and so I would like to.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a minor. I'm going to say minor study. I still think it was amazing that you, at a month old, you had these guys
and
walking
that's
around.
Right. That's a take-home message. Like, I mean, I'd recommend DHA, but I mean, in the end, I just think the take-home message is a lot of people don't think that these animals are smart.
Yeah. That's
they are.
They are. They're totally smart. And at 4 weeks old, they're smart.
Mm-hmm.
I have delivered a lot of baby horses, and it still amazes me to this day that within the first hour they're standing, within 3 to 4 hours they can walk and almost run with mom
mm-hmm.
within a few hours, whereas we are helpless. I am 40 years later, and I'm still helpless.
Sure. And observing these guys in the pasture when they were 1 and 2 months old for that part of the study – I mean, they're social. They had very complex social structures. They were understanding language already.
Babies. And mm-hmm. our baby, you know, still pooping their diapers at 3, 4 years
yeah,
old.
Yeah, I mean, my 15-month-old does not understand when the 4-year-old is angry that he has his toy or upset. Laughing. Yeah, they, you know, they're. I mean, obviously, there's major differences between our species, but. Yeah, they, you know, the horses have to learn that
for
fast.
Being the dominant species on the planet, we're not very smart as babies
versus
horses.
Not as big. Horses figure it out pretty fast. Yeah, and I think the more we study them, the more we realize.
So, you know, then you carry that to other hoofstock species. So, I mean, I know we all think cows are just dumb, but they're not.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
no,
not. They're very smart.
Pigs are smarter than dogs.
Very incredibly smart.
So all y'all out there that love dogs, I'm one of them. That little pot-bellied pig.
I still think cats rule the planet. I still think they're the smartest because they have us. Yeah,
well,
we feed them all day.
And unfortunately, they're always going to get a bad rap because they're such pains in the butts to train.
Yeah.
I think it's probably because they're so smart. They're like, you do that.
Yeah, they're smart.
They're like training us. Yeah. That's how smart they are. They've like flipped the coin.
Turds. All right. So nutrition, really quick. It's pretty easy. They eat grass all day. I mean, there's really not a lot.
Like 16 hours a day.
Yeah, that's what they're made to do. When we did some behavioral research with the Grevy zebra, small wild ass, domestic horses, and these are all in captive settings, they still just ate all day. So it was kind of boring. Thanks, Angie.
No.
Like, you got me into this. I was like so excited.
You must not love to look at horses as much as I do.
And it was fun. Like the small wild ass, I actually saw a lot of cool stuff with them.
Yeah.
But it is boring. They just eat all day. And then that one, within the, you know, was it like within an hour or two, you finally see that one cool behavior.
Yeah.
And then it's back to eating for 2 hours. So, but that's what they do. That's what they're made to do. They have small stomachs. They eat this grass. They pass it on. They ferment it in their hind gut and then pass it through. So don't really need to jump too much into that.
No.
They eat grass.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they
they
do.
They're grazers. Przewalski horses, grazers.
Right. Zebras, grazers. Mm-hmm. Every species of zebra. I think the donkey, the wild ass, is a little bit different.
They're a little more opportunistic, I think.
Right, because they... I mean, they're from desert regions.
Sure.
So North Africa, even in Asia.
They've got to eat some weird stuff to survive.
Yeah. And there's not grasslands.
Yeah.
So they got to go and find maybe some browse, maybe some other things.
Mm-hmm.
So their dietary requirements are different than, say, horses.
Right.
But still pretty similar. I mean, pretty similar.
So reproductive-wise, they're very similar to horses. Stallions are going to come of age between 2 and 3 years. With mares, it's probably about the same as far as their age.
Right.
Stallions... probably because of herd dynamics, usually don't breed a mare until mm-hmm. they're probably about 5 years of age when they've earned a little bit higher status. Because stallions, once they're kicked out of the herd, they'll sometimes form bachelor groups right. until they can find basically make their own harem. And then they also are seasonally polyestrous, mm-hmm. which what that means is they come into a season, they come into heat or they come into estrus when it's a good time.
Right.
And typically that's in the spring here in North America, similar where and over in China, Mongolia, where that's their breeding time. It's about 6 months right. or so. And their gestation, just like a horse, is about 11 months. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense. They get pregnant in the
spring.
In the spring, and then they
have babies, in the spring. And that's, you know, anytime you teach reproduction, that's when most animals are having babies.
Yeah, the grass is good. Right. I mean, that's when you want to have, you want to give your...
The birds are singing, the insects are...
Who doesn't love spring? Yeah. Ugh, sometimes I get whiffs of spring, I get so happy. And their courtship is not too aggressive mm-hmm. because the mares, they have what is like an active estrus where they are...
Interested.
Yeah, they're interested. Yeah. They have behavior, showing behavioral signs, and the stallions do a really cool behavior similar to in horses, what's called a Flemin response.
Yeah.
Where when the mare's sending signals through her urine and whatnot, and he'll sniff that region, and he'll stick his upper lip up to smell those goodies and to basically probably find out for sure that she's...
Yeah, they're smelling for hormones. Mm-hmm, but
to make sure
she's... Other species of cats do it.
Mm-hmm.
And people, you always see the funny horse pictures, the upper lip. And that's what it is they're inhaling that.
Yeah, they're like...
Aroma.
They want that strong aroma. Yeah. And so the mare is typically receptive for the most part. And then... When foals are born, they're going to stay with their mom for up to 2 years. They're going to stay in the harem. And then if it's a mare, it'll stay mm-hmm. most likely in the harem. If it's a stallion, he'll probably be kicked out because that whole dominance thing, unless he's super strong or something, he's probably not going to, you know, defeat the male.
So conservation status, Angie, there's about 2,000 in the world, Przewalski horses, and about, 700, 800 in the wild or in parks?
Yeah, I think...
Isolated, 1,200 mm-hmm. in captivity?
Some of the more recent numbers have said that there's been a little over 380 that have been born...
In the wild. Or in some probably these parks, you know, because they're really protected parks.
Sure.
For a lot of them. So not free-ranging, you know, they still have fencing around them, right?
Right.
Pretty good. The only problem is... Again, coming from 12 animals, they're highly inbred, which has led to some behavioral issues. I know a couple studies where I've read where stallions have killed foals, like just abnormal. That's not normal horse behavior. Some of that's been a problem. I'm reading studies on their genetics. You know, as far as one of the big things in genetics is there's a thing called... I'm not going to go down this path today. I will eventually because
it's... He really wants to.
I do. But it's called the MHCs. Major histocompatibility complex. And the one that I really love about this one is just really quickly, I don't know if your siblings, and hopefully my sister never hears this or my brother, but do your siblings ever just stink to you? Like you walk by them and their BO is bad. And
I mean, they probably say that about me. I think I'm the stinky one.
Okay,
family.
So you're the stinky of the family.
For sure.
But your spouse... probably smells pretty good to you
most of the time. Not after zookeeping.
Not after zookeeping, no, but most of the time.
No, he smells like a flower
all
the time.
Yes, and my wife is that way with me. So they have found in humans and in other species and horses, this MHC helps us in mate selection. So when you meet somebody and they kind of stink to you, that means you probably have very similar genetics. Now, the MHC is important because... that is what gives us immunity. It adds to our immunity genes.
It diversifies it.
Right. So it makes us fight bugs and worms and you know, all the gross stuff that it tries to kill us in our bodies. Well, our MHCs are constantly evolving to stay ahead of parasites and other things so we can combat these things. So what they have found is if you go, and they've done many studies on this, if you go and smell people that smell really good to you, most likely, and not being masked by soaps
perfumes
and stuff, like just their natural scent, if they smell really good to you, chances are, most likely, you have diverse immune genes. Your MHCs are completely different. People that stink to you, their natural body odor, stinks to you generally means you guys have very similar immune genes, and over time we've developed this nose to find mates that will give our offspring the best chance of surviving, right? So this is why I love it. This is why MHC is, now I can go all day into MHC stuff, and I will dissect it over the next year in this program. So anyways, they've done that in horses too. The MHCs with the Przewalskis are very similar. So they're not very diverse.
You need more diversity in there to help fight off diseases.
Exactly. So these animals are at risk in the wild. And this is the problem. The purpose I bring this up is not just to go into geeky science stuff. There's always a reason I bring this up. When we get down to these small critical populations, like the northern whites, there's no diversity there in their genetics.
Right.
And this is why we need diversity in genetics, I guess. Because a parasite's going to evolve, or a virus is going to evolve, some bacteria is going to evolve and come and hit that population. And it kills off the ones that are susceptible, but because of their genes, other ones are resistant. Well, when everybody has similar genes and we find that one disease that wipes them all out, they're gone.
Right.
They're done.
There's not the ones left standing.
Right. So, you know, when diseases hit a population, that's why we want a diverse set.
Well, and in speaking of diseases, although these horses, the pea horses and their numbers are doing better, they are still very susceptible, like you said, to diseases and lack of genetic diversity. Mm. But also from potential hybridization with domestic horses and also diseases that domestic horses have.
The domestics, yeah, that can spread it pretty well. Like, you know, even dog populations, like maybe we'll do African wild dog at some point this next year, because feral dogs in Africa have a horrific impact on them. And, you know, again, this is why we need to try to maintain these populations at healthy levels. It's why SSPs are, species survival programs are important.
I think the research that's being done and reproductive and behavioral health of these pea horses in North America and some of the zoological institutions is so critical, because they're also saving gametes and learning more about artificial reproductive technologies. To try to bank some of these genetics. Right. God forbid if another hard winter or a disease or something hit the population really hard, that maybe we could start all over again.
Right.
But that takes time, money, and resources. And there's so many other animals that need this.
Right.
It would be better if we could just maintain the population in the wild that we have.
Right.
But that's hard, because there's...
That should be the first choice, but then...
That should be,
but
there...
We need all these backups.
Yeah, and that's... I mean, and... The international group leading these efforts and these coalitions are smart. The pea horses are not all in one park. Mm-hmm. There's 3, 4, 5 different parks. But also because of that, there's small fragmented populations. A lot of them are surrounded by livestock and pastoral lands. But yeah, and they'll work with the local people around to help preserve and keep these pea horses safe where they're at.
Right. And that's, you know, reading the reintroduction success stories with them, you have to work with the local populace.
Absolutely.
And they have established these regions where they can, you know, release them, and the locals are invested in those populations. So reading the studies on how to successfully reintroduce animals to the wild, it's so complicated and so many issues. Again, a whole nother separate episode.
And interestingly enough, Chris, there's actually a new science in the zoological world called reintroduction science.
Right.
So for a lot of the, you know, naysayers about animals in a captive setting or whatnot, that's a different discussion for a different day. But there are actually young scientists, young minds working to try to figure out how to best get these guys back into the wild.
Right. And we're talking about like predators, teaching predators how to hunt, you know, making sure how do we set up the proper environment, even though, you know, there's only a quarter of the natural environment remaining from, say, 1,000 or 2,000 years ago.
Yeah. And with the pea horses, because their climate's so harsh, I mean, we're talking about the Gobi Desert and some of these other places they've been reintroduced, trying to learn from the mistakes of what we've done right and what we've done wrong about areas to release them in. And so there's a big push to try to radio collar some of them so we can learn more about them.
Yeah, and that brings me to the last thing I was going to bring up is, I actually read a recent article just this past week talking about the radio collars that they initially used with the horses. They hated them. Like, you see them on elephants and stuff, these big leather.
Yeah, invasive.
Yeah, they hate them. And I can imagine a horse not wanting that, you know, around their neck all the time. So they've actually developed these smaller ones, and they've braided them in the manes and tails, like we talk about doing with some domestic stuff, like hurricanes and stuff. And that is working just fine. And then they're using these GPS trackers to track where they go, study some of their behavior. So, yeah, that's cool that you brought that up, because I just read that last night.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the whole reintroductory science, like learning more, learning from our mistakes, because we're humans. We're not perfect. The issues are complex.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the Grevy zebra, they had some trouble reintroducing them in the wild because of poaching, right? I think they were killed and shot, so the locals weren't invested in them. And they've learned.
Right.
You know, we just can't release these animals and bless them and say, good luck.
No.
They have to be carefully managed.
Yeah. I mean, I think the native local population near a reserve is one of the biggest factors of success or not. Right. And so, once again, that's why we're here. Yeah. Education brings people together. It makes people able to make better, well-rounded decisions. And so that's what we hopefully are doing here each week.
Right. So just really quick, conservation tip of the week, recycle. Let me reiterate that. Just recycle, please. Recycle your paper products. Angie and I have talked about reducing plastic. We, live it, breathe it, recycle, help.
Yep, I brought my water bottle here today that I fill up.
Recycling is critical. That is a big part. So any special organizations to support?
Yes, Chris. I'm very excited about this one, obviously, because it's horse-related.
Right.
But my organization of the week is called Save the Wild Horse, and you can find it at savethewildhorse.org. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Listen, learn, share. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.